for, so we'll go ahead and start that, and then if other folks are here for other bills, we can interrupt that testimony. But I would like to open public hearing, House Bill 3344, and ask Fred Green to come up. He's more than 100 miles away from Salem.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
My name is Fred Green. My wife and I own F&R Enterprises, a trucking business in Coos Bay North End. Our business was started in 1983. We currently operate 17 log trucks in Oregon. We also operate 4 highway trucks that are prorated in 6 states, Oregon, Washington, California, Idaho, Nevada, and Utah. 3 of our highway trucks are flatbeds. 1 truck is a dry van, husband and wife team. 74% of our gross income is from our log trucks, 26% from our highway trucks. And in 1998, our business had a gross income of $2 million. In 1998, we paid 6.3% of our gross income for EUC and licenses for all of our trucks. We have a total of 29 employees with a payroll of a little over $700,000. We provide group medical insurance for our employees. When I first heard about the proposed change from the present system to a weight mile tax to a fuel tax and increase in registration, I was very skeptical about the change. And I put a lot of time into studying it, the changing to a fuel tax and increased registration. And I'm in favor of repealing the present system of the weight mile tax. I have compared the proposed legislation to what we paid in 98, and I feel it treats us fairly. Changing to a fuel tax is going to cut down on the amount of paper we are required to do, and also cut out of a lot of paperwork for the state of Oregon. With the present weight mile tax, the Oregon Department of Transportation has to do audits to see that truckers are paying their weight mile tax correctly and paying for all the miles and time they operate. With a fuel tax, the state will not have to do any auditing. This will save the state money and save the trucker time and money, as they do not have to get the paperwork together for audits. With a fuel tax, it will do away with evasion. This makes it fair for everyone, and I feel will generate more money for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Green. Are there any questions from the panel? You obviously looked at the registration fee going up 11 times, and you'd rather have that than have to deal with 8 miles. That might be your testimony?
Yes, I would.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Donna, did you want to introduce the other folks that are signed up, or what was the process there?
Yes, a couple, but I will do this really quick. For the record, my name is Donna Scott. I am the member of I'm the director of member relations for the Oregon Trucking Association. And what I have done today is brought in some trucking industry folks that are small companies and medium-sized companies to talk to you about why they favor going to a diesel fuel tax over paying the weight mile tax. To start with, I'll just have Richard come up here.
Okay. Yeah, we can handle 3 at a time there. Jeff?
Good morning. My name is Rob Ferris, and I'm a Ferris Lumber Company, and we operate about 37 trucks and have about 43 drivers and 5 others in supervisory and maintenance and administrative roles. Our company favors the repeal of the weight mile and replace it with the a fuel tax. It would be much simpler to administer. I think we would save one person on our staff that we could reassign to another position. We view this bill as revenue neutral, and it would really simplify our lives. We see that it would impact perhaps as many as 100 people in the state government, and the private sector has had to downsize and to remain competitive, and we think that that would be a positive thing for the taxpayers in the state of Oregon also.
Thank you, Mr. Friedman.
My name is Cliff Bates. I'm the president of Redmond Heavy Hauling, a trucking company headquartered in Portland, Oregon. We operate about 30 trucks in 11 western states. Redmond Heavy Hauling is a wholly owned subsidiary of Babbler Brothers, an Oregon company in business since 1929 that employs about 200 people. With your permission, the best way I can illustrate how our company feels about this is just to tell a very brief little story of an audit we went through. Nothing unusual about this audit, and that's the point I'd like to make, is there is nothing unusual about this audit. It's happening somewhere in Oregon as we speak right now. 1990, we contacted UC at that time and asked if they would help us to work with our programmer to construct a system to pay weight mile tax and fuel taxes in our state. They sent a gentleman named Bill Tucker up, since retired, who worked with our programmer to develop a system. He inspected it and blessed it, said it was fine. We developed a system of paperwork for our drivers to use to provide the data input for that program. We used that program, we still use it today. In 1995, auditor from GC showed up. She told us she was there to inspect how we were paying in the other states. She wasn't there to audit for the state of Oregon. She just wanted to make sure that we were paying for the other state. And so she did her audit. Took her about 2 weeks. At the end of that time, she says, well, she says, I have good news and I have bad news. She says, in 10 western states, you owe about $50. That's the good news. In one western state, Oregon, you owe $15,000. She says, how is that possible? We're using your program. We're using the same drivers, the same paperwork, the same input method. Everything's the same. You blessed us. How can we owe $15,000? Interestingly enough, the CFO of my company asked me the same question. Mr. Bates, what are you doing wrong down there? I'd like to know why you owe $15,000. So I invited Bob Otley up, who was the audit supervisor, to sit down with my CFO and explain to him why we had incurred a $15,000 bill. Not that it matters, but the CFO at that time was had an MBA from Stanford. I don't know how you feel about the Cardinal, but he should have been able to understand the basic forms and the basic theory behind to pay the fuel tax. I felt that he should. Mr. Otley and Mr. Edwards sat down, and for an hour, one of the most pleasant hours I've ever had in my entire life, Mr. Otley tried to explain to Mr. Edwards how this fuel weight mile program works in Oregon. After an hour, they both fairly frustrated, angry. Mr. Edwards left, and we got down to the real business at hand, which was negotiating the amount of fine. We negotiated it down to $2,000. Everybody was happy. We shook hands. They left. We gave the state of Oregon $2,000. I don't at all mind giving the state of Oregon $2,000. They would have asked nicely, I would have gladly done it. The point I want to make is that Redmond Heavy Hauling spent at least $2,000 to mail that check. The state of Oregon spent at least $2,000 to get that check. So we spent $4,000 to collect $2,000 in taxes. This is typical. I'm here today to ask for your help. I certainly want to pay my taxes. In 10 Western states, I can demonstrate clearly that I'm able to pay my taxes. I don't have any problem paying my taxes. We've looked at this. This is revenue neutral for Redmond Heavy Hauling. But it cost us almost as much to pay this tax as the tax itself. There's an easier way to do this. Much simpler. The reason that truckers keep coming back to this city to talk about this tax is not because we don't want to pay our taxes. We need your help to pay our taxes. We're not getting the value out of ODOT that we deserve, and neither are the taxpayers in Oregon. Taxpayers in Oregon are being poorly served. Trucking industry is being poorly served. There's a quicker, better, faster, cheaper way. Right there. Pretty much says it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bates.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Tim Larkin. I'm the president of SS Flagel Trucking Company in Prineville. We have 65 employees and 27 owner-operators, about $2.4 million a year in our annual payroll. We have three different operations. We have a maxi fleet or extended weight fleet of 37 trucks hauling up to 105,000 pounds in the Pacific Northwest, and approximately 85% of those miles are in Oregon. And then we have a regular fleet of dry van and flatbed trucks hauling 80,000 pounds. About 25% of their miles are in Oregon. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3344, and there are many issues surrounding the weight mile tax. I feel justified replacing it with the diesel fuel tax. Issues such as uniformity with the surrounding states, evasion, I think are very significant. But I'm going to focus on some issues, one of which Cliff just did, the complexity, accuracy, and efficiency of our current weight mile tax system. The complexity of the current weight mile tax is demonstrated in many ways, not the least of which is in the paperwork needed to report it. For our company of 70 trucks in the fourth quarter of 1998, we were able to file for 23 states on a two-sided single piece of paper. That represents 23 states, about 50% of our miles. In Oregon, it took 21 pages to file that report, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. The reality is that the weight mile tax, as Cliff demonstrated through their audit process, defies computerization accurately. Therefore, we have to input by hand a significant number of entries for each truck. And when it's all said and done, this is the reporting necessary for us to file for one quarter's worth of weight mile tax. And we compare that again to 23 states for the same period of time. That has got to demonstrate the complexity of this issue. We have attempted numerous times to come up with a way to computerize this system, but we have not been able to do it. Several programmers have come in and said, absolutely, we can do that. The best software companies in the trucking industry have come in and said, oh, absolutely, we can do that. When it comes down to it, we can't do it because of our type of operation. So we have to develop an ancillary system outside of our mainframe in order to capture the information necessary for the weight mile tax. In any given day, our trucks will report at four different weight mile tax categories. Under the diesel tax, the miles will be generated as a byproduct of our computerized dispatch. Our entire operation is computerized. We put a truck in and we say that it's going from Prineville to L.A. It'll generate the miles that it's driving in Oregon to get down to the California border, and it'll hold those. All those miles are automatically generated. A fuel tax would require absolutely no more input from us than our system already generates. The weight mile tax requires 40-plus hours a month for us just to input the information necessary for that single state. We talk about accuracy of the weight mile tax, and I often hear arguments that although our weight mile tax is significantly more burdensome administratively, it is both necessary and justifiable based on the degree of accuracy it provides in assessing the tax. Since it is determined that the wear on one that a vehicle puts on our road is a factor of the weight and the number of axles spreading that weight out, it is argued that the system based on miles driven at various weight categories would indeed be the most accurate. However, what we have in Oregon is not strictly a weight mile tax. It's an axle mile tax. And it has little to do with the weight and a whole lot more to do with the axles and the configurations that you have on your truck. We are required by carriers to declare certain weight axle configurations for each of our power units. For example, if we are bobtailing a tractor with no trailer, we have 3 axles on the ground, we have 0 payload, and we are able to file at the 46,000-pound rate of 6.05 cents per mile. When we add a 2-axle semi-trailer, we now have 5 axles on the ground, and therefore we're obligated to pay at 13.65 cents whether we're fully loaded at 80,000 pounds or we're empty at 30 to 35,000 pounds. In our operation, in which we frequently haul loads in excess of 80,000 pounds, the problem becomes greater. If I'm driving a 7-axle combination, which has a declared weight of 105,500 pounds, I have to pay 15.1 cents per mile, even though I may be empty, with a total combined weight of less than 40,000 pounds. In this configuration, I'm creating no greater wear on the road than the bobtail situation is, and yet my tax has gone up by over 250%. Now, you might say, well, that's insignificant, but in my operation and in a lot of operations within the state, flatbed operations, I have an empty mileage rate of 27%. So 27% of the time, I am paying a tax up to 250% more than would be necessary at the empty rate if I didn't have any trailers. It has nothing to do with the weight of the truck. It has everything to do with how many axles are on the ground. When you calculate the difference between the two rates and multiply it by our Oregon empty miles, you arrive at a figure of just over $50,000 that we pay in excess of what a weight mile tax would determine for us. The system's complexity further affect its accuracy. I can beat that scenario somewhat by decking my back trailer. When I'm at 105,000 pounds, I have 2 trailers. I can take that back trailer, I can put it on the top of my front trailer when I'm empty, change the axle configuration from 7 or 8 to 5, and I can go from the 15.1 cents down to the 13.6. However, I have no control over whether my driver does actually deck that trailer, and I have no control over whether he reports it accurately. Therefore, I have to pay a tax based to a large degree on the accuracy of an individual who, though very good at operating this equipment, is not known for his love of paperwork. And that is where the entire weight mile tax system information is based. It has to be done by the driver who does not understand the complexities of the system. Is this an accurate system for assessing road tax? I don't think so. Now compare this to a diesel fuel tax. It is simply a factor of how many miles did I drive in Oregon and what my average miles per gallon were. Again, compare this stack of paper to the single sheet that I file for the other 23 states I drive in. The third is efficiency. You know, as trucking companies, we are in an industry that is extremely competitive and that profit margins are very slim. On average, the industry deals with about a 3% profit margin. True efficiency requires a keen awareness of the law of diminishing returns. At some point, the amount of expenditures in both time and money are no longer worth the ever-decreasing incremental gains in accuracy. The question is, can we develop a system which maintains a reasonable level of accuracy while saving us substantial sums of time and money? We had already discussed the concept of the greater weight axle, the greater weight per axle causing greater wear. Is it possible for the diesel fuel tax to reflect this at all? Of course it is. My heavy truck at 105,000 pounds average about 4.5 miles to the gallon. My 80,000-pound truck average about 6 miles to the gallon. So indeed, my heavy trucks are paying more tax than the others. AAA and others would say that we are trying to get out of our tax. They were trying to impose an unfair system, but we're asking for the same system that cars pay for all the time. It doesn't matter whether you drive a 1967 Volkswagen Beetle that gets 20 miles a gallon or a new compact that gets 35 miles a gallon. Those cars put the same amount of wear on the road, and if you put studded tires on, they increase the wear substantially. But that 35-mile-an-hour car gets substantially lower tax per mile than the other car does. So we're talking about a system that seems to work for one side and not for the other. You consider the calculations for savings under a diesel fuel tax, the numbers get quite staggering. I have received numbers that indicate an initial reduction in employees of 106,000, resulting in a savings of $6.2 million a year, with an eventual savings of $10 million. If this opportunity presented itself in the private sector, it couldn't be passed up. We have the ability to collect the same revenue while saving $6 to $10 million to a system that is already widely accepted by all the other states. We are the only state that does not have a diesel fuel tax, and there's very, very few that augment that with a weight mile tax. The survey of trucking companies recently completed by the AOI indicates 73% are in favor of this new structure, and that another 8% are not sure, and in light of the complexity of the system, that shouldn't surprise anybody. How can we possibly justify the expenditure of another $6 to $10 million to collect the very same revenue that the body you are taxing considers the proposed system to be fair? In fact, it could be argued that a diesel fuel tax is more accurate because it does a better job of spreading the burden among all industry users. In case after case, taxing fuel at the rack has resulted in substantial revenue increases due to the recovery of evasion. Is your alleged accuracy worth the price? We face the law of diminishing returns, and efficiency dictates that we are close enough. We have agreed to a revenue-neutral system based on ODOT's numbers that does not transfer the burden to others. And I know there's others who will testify that we are, in fact, doing that, but I don't understand how they can come to that conclusion. We have said we will produce the same taxes. We will continue to carry our share of the burden as we have in the past. We have shown overwhelming support for the change from the body who bears the tax as they anticipate relief from administrative burden. And we have the example of every other state, and in fact testimony from many, stating the substantial improved efficiency of a diesel fuel tax. And finally, we can achieve this by freeing up $6 to $10 million. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. You've obviously heard the arguments on this issue before.
Yes.
Certainly able to address them. Are there any questions from the committee? I had two questions I wanted to ask you, and you touched on it somewhat, Mr. Larkin, and that is, do you believe in the principle of the cost responsibility in terms of the impact on the highway truck portion compared to car portion, they should be paying that percentage and that shouldn't be shifted over to cars?
Yes, I do agree with that.
Okay. Do you all agree with that principle? And in this scenario under House Bill 3344, not counting the time and the paperwork, how would the amount of tax that each of you pay change from what you're currently paying now?
Under that scenario, I would save about $30,000 a year.
Okay, in tax?
In tax.
Okay. And you?
I'm certain exactly how much you'd save, but I think it would be, because we run so many miles, I think it would be a savings for us in addition.
Difficult to calculate exactly. My feeling is that we would be within a few $1,000 either way from where we are right now. I might add that I would willingly pay a little more if you folks would just make it easier.
my question is, if you believe in the cost responsibility share, and yet two out of three of you in this panel at least say you think your costs go down. You said like $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
How can we maintain the roughly same amount of revenue coming in if you're going to be paying less?
I think how I answered your question was the difference between trucks and automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
And trucks would be paying the same fare. And I believe that there is, or at least I've heard an argument that different classes of trucks may pay more or less than they would. But comparison between cars and trucks is the main thing.
Right. I guess I'm looking for somebody who's saying, yes, we're going to pay $30,000 more in order to offset whoever's going to say we're going to pay $30,000 less if we're going to retain the same balance between cars and trucks.
Part of the calculation for revenue neutrality that went into this process was the savings of the $6 to $10 million. So there is the same, it's revenue neutral when you factor in those savings. There will be some carriers paying less money, and depending on the type of operation, as I demonstrated, where we have a substantial portion of our miles are empty miles, and we're paying for those being loaded at $105,000 now. When you look at those type of operations, there's going to be some savings in them. When you look at operations that have a substantial amount of Oregon miles per truck, there's going to be some savings because that registration fee portion of it's going to be spread over more miles. So there's going to be those that will end up paying more are those that have to pay the registration fee and have the lesser miles. But nonetheless, as we look at that and as we go out to the pool of companies, there is a consensus that they're willing to do that across the board. There's going to be some winners, there's going to be some losers, but nobody's going to lose very big, and everybody is going to eliminate the weight mile tax. And I think that's the thing that's important.
At what point do you choose, in your operation, because you do run in a number of other states, what's the tax difference on the diesel tax that's going to cause you to fill up in the neighboring state that's a penny or 2 pennies less and not in Oregon?
Currently?
Yeah, anytime.
Well, under the proposal, that's the beauty of the proposal, is that you're, I don't remember the exact amount, but I think 23, 24 cents in Washington, 23 cents in California, 25 cents in Oregon, 20-some cents in Idaho. We are going to be uniform with the surrounding states. So there will be no incentive now to evade that there is now. Right now with the weight mile tax, if I'm going from Portland and I'm going east and I drive down 84, which everybody is going to do, and I don't cross the scale, then I don't have to report those miles in Oregon. I can report them in Washington. Now, we certainly don't do that, but there's a lot of companies who actually do that. The reason is because it costs me 70 cents a mile to drive in Oregon on the weight mile tax. It costs me 20 cents to drive in Washington on the weight mile tax. I have a terminal in Kalama, Washington, and when you look at my tax and license difference between the two states, it's phenomenal. So when you make yourself uniform with the surrounding states, then that incentive for evasion goes away, and that's a big part of this whole thing. And although we haven't factored that evasion issue into the revenue neutrality of this, we think it's going to pay great dividends as we go down the road.
So my question, I guess, is 2 or 3 cents difference between Oregon and Washington and Oregon and California going to cause you to tell your drivers fill up before you get back to Oregon?
No. We have to, that's what the district report is, that one-page report is, you have to go ahead and pay for those miles you drove in that state anyway. So you just get a credit for the tax you paid at the pump, wherever you paid it, and then the states equalize that out. So when it gets to a 2 or 3 cent thing, no, there's no reason to decide one way or the other.
All right. I want to thank you all very much, and I appreciate your tolerance of the movement of the committee members too coming and going. I know that can be distracting, but we're always being called in and out for various things. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Right.
My name is Darlene Walters. And we have Chuck Walters Trucking, which is a very small trucking company. And this is my first time up here, and I wanted to just share with you a little bit about some of the issues that have come up for us in the paper burden area of these things that we're trying to resolve. And with the way tax mile, and of course, the Flegel company and those have already gone over all those figures, but I wanted to let you know that we've grown from one truck to several trucks. And due to the paper burden, I've had to give up a 10-year career in the corporate world to come home and take care of the paperwork. So for a small company. And we'd like to see the way tax mile go and get the fuel tax and get a fair share in so that we were able to pay our taxes and have the freedom of to be able to run our business to do that. So.
Thank you. Where's your company?
We're in Lebanon, Oregon, and we have a couple flatbeds that are running 5 western states, and they fuel in Oregon. And then we have one that runs 100% in Oregon. But the paperwork is gone from about 15 hours per month up to about 20 hours a week for us.
If you, Ms. Walters, if you saw a registration that last year was $320 and this next year is $3,600, how would you feel about that?
If it's an equal taxation across the board to where we're not paying a large increase, but that if the fuel tax offsets the registration and we're paying around the same amount of money, it would ease our paper burden. We'd still be able to pay our taxes and still be able to make a living. And that's what we're concerned about.
Thank you. And my name is Gary Pierce. I'm part of this Chuck Walters trucking operation. I'm the son-in-law. Like Darlene mentioned, we're green as grass when it comes to being up here before you people, but we're pretty darn nervous, too, about the fact that small operations like we got could be a thing of the past. Small business in the state of Oregon is, as far as I know, is still the largest employer, and we would love to grow. Now, this fuel tax, providing we don't get burdened too bad with increased registration fees, we can live with. But our major concern is that in an operation our size, we cannot afford any substantial increase at all. The rates haven't gone up for the 3 years I've been flatbedding. In order for us to stay a small family business, we can't afford any increase. And we don't mind paying for the use of our roads in Oregon or the other states we run in. But like Darlene mentions, it's incredibly complicated, and we're still trying to learn. She's pulling her hair out trying to learn it and get it done to meet what Oregon requires. But our major concern at this point is the fuel tax would be simpler. The fuel tax would be fair to somebody the size of us, which is just a small, you know, 3-truck operation at this point, and we could survive and do the things we love to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay,
Michael. Thank you, Mr. Chair. A big piece of the funding will be in registration fees, I think, well over 50%, 58%. And there's a lot of uncertainty as to whether what shifts and changes will occur such that whether or not indeed it will be revenue neutral. If and there's no provisions for revenue neutrality to be sustained in the bill if the registration fees fall short. So what would you recommend that we do in this bill to actually create revenue neutrality sustained into the future on the registration fee side if the registration fees come in lower than predicted?
Are you asking if registration fees don't make up enough difference and Oregon Department of Transportation has a shortfall? how would we feel about paying more?
How should we fix this? I keep hearing that everyone believes and supports revenue neutrality, and that you're willing to pay the same overall amount, but in a different form that's less complicated. So how do we make sure that that in fact occurs?
Well, that's way above me, for sure. But to maintain the roads in Oregon, the bridges and that sort of thing, costs X amount of dollars. We've been paying so much in taxes over the years. You know, like I say, we're green as grass on this and very ignorant, but we're concerned about saving our business. That does concern me that if we pay if we go to the fuel tax and pay an increase of 300 or 400% in registration fees and it doesn't cover it, is the state of Oregon going to come back with their hand out for more to keep, you know, the roads up? At this point, I couldn't honestly tell you whether we could survive if it goes up much more than what's proposed now. You know, we've had a fuel increase, you know, just like everybody else with their gasoline increase here since January of almost 30%. The rates haven't gone up, so I at this point, I couldn't tell you if Oregon needed more registration, if we can survive. I really couldn't honestly tell you at this point.
Thank you.
What we're seeing and what limited information we have today would make the paperwork burden easier on us. It seems fairly close. I don't think anybody's going to cut a fat hog here and come out smelling like a rose, whether it's trucking industry or Oregon Department of Transportation. But you know, we're just looking to keep doing what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, sir, I guess we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
If it's still standing.
Good point.
Representative Witt. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your support for this bill is not to lower the amount, if I understand your testimony, it's not to lower the amount of taxes that you are paying, but it is to get away from the burdensome paperwork requirements that the current system imposes upon you and the cost associated with that. Isn't that correct?
Well, yeah, that is correct. I mean,
if I can follow, Mr. Chair?
If I were to sit here and tell you that everybody in this room would love to have lower taxes, but we do have to be realistic.
Follow, Mr. Chair? So based upon that, if the design and the intent of this bill is to be revenue neutral, if this bill passes and we find out that for some reason it's not revenue neutral, but it's not bringing in the same dollars or percentage of funds that was coming in under the weight mile system, don't you think it would be appropriate then for the legislature to come back and make some changes in registration fees or the tax to assure that it's revenue neutral, while at the same time continuing the policy of eliminating the burdensome requirements that the weight mile tax imposes upon your firm?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, my name again for the record is Donna Scott. I'm with Oregon Trucking Association. There is a provision in the bill that when that ODOT will do their revenue forecast, and if the trucking industry is not paying indeed what we believe will be coming in as revenue neutrality, that there will be increases in the diesel tax until the next time the legislature meets, and then there will be a total review of all of the revenues. There has also been an amendment that came through in 3344 that puts an additional 4 cents onto the diesel tax in the year 2001-2 in case that the next legislative body does not vote for a tax increase for the trucking industry. This will become automatic.
Thank you.
I would also like to take just a moment to speak to Representative Murphy's question on the diesel tax and how it goes around on the different states. And I think there's still some misconceptions on how the diesel tax is calculated and paid. And with the International Fuel Tax Agreement, it does not matter where you buy your diesel. If you get 5 miles a gallon on your diesel tax and you run 25 miles in Oregon, you pay for those 5 gallons that you burned in Oregon, whether you bought the fuel here or not.
I'm not sure I asked that question, but I'm happy to hear the answer.
I just did answer. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming up.
One more thing. Again, I represent and talk with our members throughout the state. We have chapters in every location around the state, and we could bring folks in here if there are more people you want to talk to, if there are different people. I know I have spoke with folks that if this bill is going to cost $30,000, that they see some efficiencies they'll be able to gain. So if you would like us to bring more folks in here, we'd be more than happy to do that.
We can talk about that later. I know you've been having them fax and phone and email.
They call. Thank you.
Okay, I have Terry Smalley.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Ruffin. I'm Director of Urban Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Association. I have with me this morning Terry Smalley, he's the Executive Vice President for the Arizona Motor Transport Association. As some of you may know, Arizona is the most recent state to eliminate its weight distance tax, and I thought it might be helpful if Terry shared a little bit about Arizona's experience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My background primarily was in motor vehicle division in the state of Texas for 5 years, and then I went on to represent the trucking industry in Texas. And 26 years ago, I moved to Arizona and started representing the trucking industry there. In 1990, we met with the Department of Motor Vehicles and decided that we wanted to change the way we registered vehicles. We wanted to register commercial vehicles the same way each of us register our passenger cars. And we began a task of changing from the cumbersome method of the weight distance tax to a more equal and easier method to pay in their taxes. We began with the first bill in 1992, and we finished with the second phase of it in 1997. Since that time, we had worked hard to make sure revenue neutrality, which is one of the biggest concerns of the members of the House and Senate in Arizona. The evasion factor was started out saying there's probably only a 5% evasion factor. As we got going into the subject and as we moved along after the first phase, it was admitted to 20% evasion by most people concerned. After the second phase in 1997, legislature passed that we would get rid of the weight distance tax. All of it. We began on the motor carrier part of it in registration and weight fees on October 1st, 1997, and the used fuel collection in 1998, January 1st. As of now, the evasion factor estimated by the Motor Vehicle Division is up to 35%. In other words, 35% of the carriers in our state are going through our state, we're not paying their full share. And there, I can tell you several instances people would call up and say, we don't like the new weight distance tax elimination bill. Well, they found out they weren't paying the full share. They were actually registering at 80,000 pounds, and when you got to other states, they were showing 80,000 pounds, but they're only reporting 50,000 pounds to the state of Arizona. So as a result, the evasion savings has helped offset the neutrality, and which might answer some of the questions Representative Murphy asked. Also, we in the forecast and in all of our situations, we also included that the economy is getting better. So all the forecasts that we have discussed has included an increased economy in Arizona. Our income tax has gone down over the last 6 years, and our economy is going up. In other words, we're collecting more taxes and giving the people a better tax break. When we did pass the final weight distance tax, we did an implementation plan. In other words, we had a joint effort between the Motor Vehicle Division and our industry. We had 13 meetings throughout the state of Arizona explaining the law and how they do it, and set up workshops and we passed out these little pamphlets to each one, and they told them, it's a how-to booklet. This is what the law says. This is what you have to do. This is how you file, and even has how you figure out your taxing and how you yourself can figure out how this law affected you. We handed these out at all 13 meetings and were well attended all over the state. One of the reasons we did this, because we felt like if they were informed, they wouldn't be coming back to the House and Senate members saying, well, I don't understand this. And it has worked very well. The motor vehicle division, after 9 months, I think Bob has passed you out what we have done financially, the motor carrier revenue facts. Mm. On lines 2, 5, and 7, I will address in
Arizona.
That's Arizona, and that was given to me by the director, Mr. Pierce and Jim Douglas, last Friday when I met with him. If you will look at those, that it shows that the categories are all producing more than the projected revenue, except number 7. Number 7 deals with apportioned vehicles. The reason that is below at this time is California didn't implement, and I have a little note there, our new weight distance fee. Therefore, they owe us approximately $4.5 million that they did not collect from their carriers, and as soon as they get that money, they will give that to us, and that will show a plus in that column also. So as of 9 months, we have a variance increase of $9 million more than we projected and the state projected, and we feel like by the end of the year, we estimate about a $13 million projected overage the projected amount. In our bill, we did several things which he did, but no bill is perfect. We had come back in 1998, and we had several slow or low-mileage carriers that didn't travel very many miles, which would have to pay more money. We adjusted that with one bill, and since that's the only bill that's been introduced since then, there's not been any disharmony among the motor vehicle division, ADOT, industry, or the carriers out there. The one thing that I'd like to also say that we saved probably motor vehicle division about $2 million by their estimates a year because we canceled out 2.5 million pieces of indicia they issue each year. And as far as our industry is concerned, it looks like we have saved about $20 million a day. And especially in the paperwork that Sean here was describing, it was a paperwork nightmare. And in essence, that's my testimony for you. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Okay, questions? Mr. Smalley. Arizona had a diesel tax prior to this, did they not?
Yes, they did. So we had a diesel tax in it, and we added on the diesel tax, we had a surcharge also, an 8-cent surcharge. What we did is we put the surcharge in with the diesel tax. That raised it to 26 cents. Then we added 1 cent to make sure it's revenue neutral till the year 2000. Then that goes away back to 26 cents.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for coming up. Tom Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing ARCO. Ryan Bowe, representing the Petroleum Jobbers, was going to be here with me. He had to go to another hearing. So what I'm going to talk about is something that he and I both agree on. I'm only going to speak to Section 81 of the bill, which is the 2.5 cent increase in the diesel tax if the revenues fall below the estimate, which is purpose of which is to keep the same level of revenue coming in for the state. My point here is that our experience in the retail sales of fuel is that price makes a great difference in terms of the volume and amount you sell. And that when you raise this diesel tax to 25 cents, you'll be about even with the rest of the western states that people travel through, and you won't have a great impact on where people purchase fuel. If you raise it 10%, 2.5 cents, because you fall below revenue, we believe there will be a significant change in where people purchase the fuel. I've talked to some of the members of the committee, and Representative Merkley especially, and what I said that our estimation was that that would cause a reduction in taxes because of reduction in fuel sold in the state, I failed to take into account the IFTA situation where those taxes are adjusted through audits on the federal level. So I want to make sure that those people that I did talk to understand that we have no idea if it will make a very big impact on the amount of taxes you collect. We do think it will make a difference on where people purchase fuel. And when people purchase fuel, that will have an impact on the Oregon businesses and on the other taxes they pay, income taxes and property taxes and so forth. We do notice a shift every time a state raises its diesel tax above the diesel tax of the adjoining states. What this will do, we think, is we think people will buy their fuel in another state, and the reason they will do that is because their out-of-pockets will be lower, and then it will get readjusted later as IFTA, and if IFTA works very well, the taxes will get paid back to the state of Oregon, as I understand how the process works. That will cause a gap in the way the revenue flows to the state. Now, the way the Section 81 works is if the revenue estimate is low, it could be low for one of two reasons. Either the diesel tax isn't high enough and the evasion wasn't significant and you're collecting less revenues than you thought you would, so you have to trigger the 2.5 cents. If you ended up triggering it because of a lag in the payments, you would have raised the diesel tax by 2.5 cents and it wouldn't be necessary. I don't have any language for you on how to change this provision. I think this is something that you as a committee working with the truckers would need to look at. I've also heard the argument that it's very possible the tax would be too high and that the evasion is significant and more revenues will roll in, and the reason for this provision is that you'd want to lower the diesel tax. Our concern for people who sell gasoline in the state of Oregon is that is not in the lowering of the tax, it's in the raising of the tax. And if you move somebody across the river into Vancouver or across the state borders into California or into Idaho to purchase their fuel, it's just not going to be sold at an Oregon station. So I have no recommendations for you. I've been sent down here by my companies simply to put on the record that we don't think this trigger clause is going to help Oregon sales. And to point out in Section 82 that you have another 4 cent diesel tax on there. And when that goes into effect, we don't have any idea what the diesel taxes are going to be in the adjoining states. It's very difficult to take the highest truck tax off weight mile and put it onto diesel and to vehicle registration and still maintain the highest tax. I will tell you that the oil industry will be in here in the future on taxes, talking about the shift to sales as you try to raise the diesel tax in the future. We're not going to be comfortable having what could possibly be a 37-cent diesel tax in Oregon compared to, who knows, 27, 28, even 30 cents in the neighboring states. So that's just the information we wanted to leave with you. And Brian, has anything to add?
Okay. Stay here for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brian Bowen, and I'm here this morning representing the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association, and they serve as the distributors for gasoline and diesel fuels. After struggling with the contents of House Bill 3344 for a considerable period of time, the Petroleum Marketers Association arrived at a position of opposing this bill. Part of the problem was that many of the member companies of the association have highly diverse fleets in terms of their weights. They end up coming out as one of the losers, as has been described by other witnesses, on the way that the tax structure would change. I have to say that there are some companies that came out substantially benefiting from the changes in House Bill 3344. But on the whole, we had more companies, again, with a diverse fleet mix that did not come out well under the bill, and the association took a position opposing it. We are very concerned in reference to what Tom was speaking about in terms of the potential competitive problems that may be faced, particularly in the border areas of the state, if the diesel fuel tax gets too high. We have seen cost shifts take place in areas where there are local gas taxes assessed, and we don't believe that diesel fuel would be any different. In fact, it might be more dramatic because it is generally purchased in larger volumes than retail gasoline is. So, again, we are very concerned about that, and I simply wanted to come before the committee this morning and put, as a matter of record, the Petroleum Marketers Association in opposition to this piece.
Thank you, gentlemen. Representative Wells.
Well, this takes us back to another discussion I always like to enter in on this. Couldn't we take care of some of this by dissolving some of the cost responsibility involvement here? Isn't that why a lot of states have done that? And I've proposed since 1995 to get rid of that. And it'd be much easier for us to decide how to protect an industry and others that are associated with that industry by dissolving cost responsibility. We're all responsible for the goods that are being trucked to us, for crying out loud. All it is protecting a mechanism of taxation. How do we do that? We know we're going to end up, no matter what kind of mechanism we have in the state, of paying a tax or having those goods transported. And where we do that has a lot to do with how we take care of industry in our state.
Mr. Chair, Arco has really no position on cost responsibility in that sense. Our distribution fleet saves a considerable amount of money under the shift. We're not opposing the bill. You raise a much bigger philosophical question, which gets into a completely another debate, and I'd like to talk to that one, Mr. Chair, if you
help. Isn't that a way that we could absolutely take care of your concerns? There's no doubt about it. We can stay as competitive as possible with the other states, surrounding states.
Mr. Chair, Representative Welch, I've often argued, not on behalf of ARCO, but on behalf of the air quality issues that we had to deal with, that the gas tax was not the best way to raise this revenue going on into the future, and creating these kinds of competitive and economic problems, both for the transporters, the truckers of the state, and for the people who sell the retail fuel, is not the long-range solution. If you raise the gas and diesel tax enough to pay for all of the needs that have been presented to these committees, we would be looking at a tax in double or triple or the tax that we're looking at now. It can't bear the weight of all of the costs. So you're back into a much longer-term debate that is not my issue in 81, but it's certainly an issue in front of this committee.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian, don't your members, the members of the Oregon Petroleum Marketers Association, see some benefit in getting away from the burdensome paperwork requirements of the current weight mile system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, my clients are in somewhat of a unique position. Yes, I don't want to represent for a moment that they're all that enamored with the current system. They face the same difficulties that many of the trucking interests that you've heard from have detailed for you. However, we're in the unique position we're in is that we're trading that burden for a different one now, and now we become the administrators of a new fuel tax, which is remitted to our suppliers. Although we do receive some consideration in the bill for some discounts to make allowances for the administrative work, frankly, most of the companies are looking at it kind of trading one hassle for another. But we're unique in that sense because we're going from being just another one of the payers that deal with the paperwork to becoming the collector.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I think what you're hearing from both of us here is that while we are trucking companies in the sense that we distribute through trucking, in a large sense we're the retailers that serve all of the rest of the trucking companies. So we're in a more unique position, which is why we don't oppose the shift. The refiners don't oppose the shift. We'll sell the gasoline whether it's in Washington or Oregon. What we do worry about is simply Section 81 here and how raising the diesel tax significantly above other states or having that potential in front of us bothers us significantly.
Tom, I asked Mr. Larkin earlier if a couple of cents one way or the other would make a difference in where he had his fleet fill up, and he said that wouldn't affect it, but it's your testimony that even a 1-3 cents difference impacts on the purchasing pattern?
Mr. Chair, when I first started representing ARCO, one of the more colorful people from the Los Angeles said that for a 3 cent difference in gas, the people that ARCO sell to would drive over a traffic median to get to the station. It's part of the market niche. There are going to be people who are very cost sensitive, especially when they pay cash out when they travel, and $100 to fill up a truck, things like that. It makes a big difference. There are lots of different things that I'm not aware of that go on inside of the trucking industry. What I'm going to report is that we see significant changes in volume on the borders of states where the taxes have changed. Now, why that happens, that's something you have to ask the trucking industry. I think somebody it wouldn't make a difference to. I don't foresee really that Portland firms that do a lot of short haul are going to drive over to Vancouver to fill up their truck and then come back, mostly because they can't get across the bridge so easily. But there would be people that would think about that. There would be people who would, if they were doing in both states, would fill up in one state rather than in another state, just avoid the cash out. And I, as I understand it, we'll get all brought out under the taxes. We'll all even out under IFTA. But that's not been our experience. I can't explain why. I think it's the human instinct to get to the cheaper gas price.
And I'm sure I would only echo that if we can draw any conclusions from what we've seen in retail gasoline, that we would see economic shifts based on cost differentials.
Okay, but if the retail price of diesel fuel was comparable within a penny or two, we probably wouldn't see that great a migration. So as I understand your testimony, Brian, is this that the change in itself is it, from your members' point of view, they're used to dealing with the weight mile tax, and any kind of a change would be different.
Be different, and there were a majority of member companies that would end up paying in the range of $10,000 to $20,000 more per year in registration fees, and it has to do with the mix in the fleets and the number of rigs they have that are under 60,000 pounds, and their ability to manage those vehicles to stay below the 30,000 mile exemption cutoff for the lower registration fee, and they can't manage their business that way. They can't manage their fleet to accommodate that, so they end up crossing that and paying the higher registration fee. And
they pay weight mile tax now. You're talking about the trucks that deliver the product.
Yes, I am.
They're paying weight mile tax now, and mm-hmm. they'd be in the same boat as these other folks who spoke this morning, paying just a diesel tax and a higher registration fee.
Right.
Okay. I just wondered if if your objection was just in switching from a unique system that nobody else had. In that case, I was going to say, well, let's go for self-serve, too, but...
That's another issue.
Is there an amendment coming, Mr. Chair?
That's 88. That's how here it comes.
We could expand the circle of the debate here. It's quite burdensome.
Mr. Chair, there might be a...
Yeah. Until the truckers go.
It might burden the truckers as well.
Yeah. I was going to suggest there might be a relating clause problem here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, is there anybody else here today to speak to House Bill 3344? Okay. Seeing no one. Dick, I did want to ask you this question, though. I think the last testimony had to do with the competitive nature of where people would buy gas, and they weren't looking at where whether the state would get back whatever its rate was. And under IFTA, we had whatever the diesel tax amount was, miles driven in Oregon would require that the state got back the comparable tax on a gallon of diesel, whatever the rate was. Is that right?
Yes, I understand my question. I think maybe an example might be in order. One of the persons testifying was talking about operating in 11 different states. So if you think about a motor carrier who is operating in 11 states, they have a home state, the state in which they're domiciled. And the only Department of Transportation they'll really deal with is the Transportation Department in their home state. So that department sort of becomes the banker, in a sense. And they have to figure out, well, in the reporting mechanism, the motor carrier is going to indicate the number of gallons of fuel bought in each of those states and the tax paid. Okay? So that determines how much money each of those states has already received. And the motor carrier also has to report the number of miles that he's driven in each of those 11 states. In addition, he has to compute an average miles per gallon for his fleet. Okay, so what he owes each state then is computed by taking that average miles per gallon times the miles driven in each state times that state's tax rate. And that's sort of the bottom line for the Department of Transportation in the home state then has an amount that's owed each one of those states by this motor carrier. He also has an amount which shows how much the motor carrier is paid. No reason for any of those to match up. He may have bought all of his fuel in one state, but he's paid a total amount of tax. The total that he owes all of those states can be added up. You've either got a surplus or a deficit. If there's a surplus, the motor carrier gets a refund. If there's a deficit, he has to make a payment when he files the report. The home state then evens out the accounts. They've got the total amount of money. They've got the total bill. And they, for each of those 11 states, they either say, you owe us, you know, they make the state has to make them a payment, or if the state has money coming, they send a check to that state. So that all balances out. So there's obviously some incentives in that whole process for misreporting, but assuming they're complying, that's exactly how it works. So what difference does it make to the trucker? That's basically a question of the float, so to speak. When do you make the payment? If you can buy in a state like Oregon right now where there is no tax on the fuel, you're talking about, saving 23 cents a gallon relative to driving over to Vancouver. You're going to have to pay that at the end of the next month. Mm-hmm. But for a couple of months, you save a few dollars.
Thank you. Okay, we'll close the public hearing at House Bill 3344. And open public hearing on House Bill 3002. Jay Merkley, you're the sponsor of the bill. Would you tell us about it?
Mr. Chair and colleagues, this bill is a very simple bill that eliminates an inequity in our state code related to the deduction for married couples filing separately as compared to married couples filing jointly. And it does that by addressing the standard deduction. And one can see on line 19 of the bill that I haven't looked at this in quite some time. It changes to $3,600 and $1,800 to adjust for the fact that it's $1,800 in the case of, as you see in line 20, in the case of an individual who is not a married individual and is not a surviving spouse, so that the base becomes $1,800 for each person rather than $1,800 in the case of an individual who is not married and yet it is only a $1,500 deduction per person in the case of people who are filing a joint return. So this makes it even and equal for everyone, regardless of whether they are single or married.
Okay. I didn't have anybody signed up to speak to this bill in public hearing. Is there anybody who wants to speak to it? Any comments from the committee?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Rick.
If I could ask Representative Merkley, is the intent and the effect of this bill simply to provide equal tax treatment as it relates to standard deductions for those who are married compared to those who are not married?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Well, I'm Jay Merkley. There's nobody here to speak, and nobody's making any comments. I don't know what else to do with it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I can, based upon what this bill does, I don't think it's, if indeed our current tax code as it relates to the basic standard deduction penalizes people that are married, I think that's an inequity that should be corrected. And if the intent of this bill and the effect of this bill addresses that inequity properly, and it takes away any kind of a marriage penalty relative to the tax code as it relates to the basic standard deduction, I think it's a good bill, and I think we should move into work session and pass the bill.
We're not posted for work session, so we can't do that.
Mr. Chair, I would support bringing it back, certainly. In a work session.
Okay. Well, that's what I wanted to hear. So, Representative Merkley, why don't you do a little vote count here and see what you got.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Take a look at it again. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3002. Open work session on House Bill 3211. Hearing Kapori. What do you have for?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had discussions on getting my days mixed up here. Yesterday, the day before.
Whatever.
about the effect of the Dash 1 Amendment. And if I could, I would like to call Mike Saba from the City of Portland to explain the Dash 1 Amendments. I had referred in my testimony earlier that the bill that we discussed when we had a public hearing last week was actually the Dash 1 Amendments, but I wanted to have Mike clarify how that is different from the original bill.
Right.
Thank you, Chair Strobeck, members of the committee. Again, I'm Mike Saba, working for the City of Portland Planning Bureau. I was here last week testifying in support of the House Bill 3211, at which time we did have the Dash Amendments before you, but I didn't speak to those. I wasn't aware that you weren't familiar with them. The amendments were our last minute amendments to try to clarify the bill, try to make the bill work for us so we could design a local program that really does what we intended to accomplish, which was to use the tax abatement as one kind of tool available to preserve low-income, affordable housing. The substance of the Dash 1 Amendments is to change the definition that currently exists in Statute 307-600-691 from multiple unit housing that is subject to a low-income rental assistance contract by an agency or subdivision of the state or the United States to a low-income low-income housing assistance contract. Point that tries to correct is that it was pointed out by one of our program managers in Portland that not all housing assistance for low-income housing is technically speaking rental assistance in this form that Section 8 housing is, for example. The federal Section 8 project-based assistance is a rental assistance contract in that it provides an amount of rental subsidy to tenants of these units. There are other kinds of housing assistance that wouldn't be technically called rental assistance contracts. So we're trying to just broaden that so that any kind of low-income housing affordability contract could be used in conjunction with this bill. And that's really what the Dash 1 Amendments try to do.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, are we in work session?
Yes, we are.
Are you ready to accept the motion?
Well, I did have a little question here. Representative Kapori, the Dash 1, you said replace the bill?
No.
They
replaced the phrase low-income rental assistance contract with low-income housing assistance contract. You'll see in the Dash 1s, the leading rental and the replacing housing
okay. Is
the gist of the Dash 1. Other than that, the bill is still intact.
Okay, and this is also a local option, is that correct?
That is correct.
And we discussed the issue of the school portion of the tax. Do you want to address what you learned about that?
Yes, I spoke with Dexter Johnson from the Legislative Council, and he said that the local option in this statute is slightly different from the local option from the statute that refers to the
2790.
Right, the bill that we had yesterday on the floor, which allows, that local option allows each individual jurisdiction to decide for themselves. The local option in this statute, there is 51% of the jurisdictions approve then the tax abatement goes through. So you don't have the option of a school district deciding to not participate unless somebody like the county or the city also decides not to participate.
Is there anybody else who wants to speak about this bill or any opinion? Seeing no one.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rasmussen.
I move the -1 amendment to House Bill 3211.
Mr. Rasmussen moves -1 amendment to House Bill 3211. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rasmussen.
I move House Bill 3211 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Rasmussen moves House Bill 3211 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative McCoy?
Aye.
Representative Murphy?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Representative Federer?
Excuse.
Representative Welch?
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Wick?
Aye.
Vice Chair Rasmussen?
Aye.
Chair Kovic? Aye. Also 3211. Move support of the due pass. Representative Sikori has secured the bill.
Since I so successfully maneuvered 2790 yesterday, I accept the challenge.
Okay. Yeah, very good. Close the work session on House Bill 3211. I want to advise all members that Thursday and Friday, we're scheduled to meet at 8 o'clock, and I would really appreciate it if you'd all be here. Because we have a ton of bills that we're going to try to take action on Thursday and Friday before we get into the deadline for moving House bills. So you might want to take a look at the agenda and go over those. And I've told people who are interested in particular bills that the success of their bill having any movement at all is directly proportional to the brevity of their testimony. We have no further business today. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen.
We're going to go there?
The longest one's also. Bless you.